on WSLRLP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPVLP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Rick Knowlton with your WSLR news headlines for Thursday, May 22nd. Leon County prosecutors in Tallahassee report that they have an open ongoing investigation into the Hope Florida Foundation, which raises financial support for Hope Florida, founded by the governor's wife, Casey DeSantis. Last month, the foundation's own chairperson testified that the organization did not follow state laws of governance, ethics, or oversight, with no bylaws, no meetings minutes, and no tax returns filed. Governor DeSantis has declared that there is no basis for the investigation and called the Republican lawmaker who provided the state attorney with documents a jackass. Manatee County commissioners have voted 5-2 against Micron Investments LLC, which sought to build a three-story, 72-unit apartment building in the Tara community near State Road 70 and I-75. Tara community residents count it as a victory after a long and determined fight against the developer. Manatee County will soon be investing over $250 million for hurricane relief thanks to a grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Details of the intended repairs and improvements are listed at Bradenton.com. A major golf tournament will be coming to Lakewood Ranch. The 2026 through 2028 Senior PGA Championships will be held at the Concession Golf Club. Club President Bruce Cassidy Sr. commented that the Concession Club, which was designed by Jack Nicklaus and Tony Jacklin, is incredibly honored and excited to host the event. Beginning May 27th, Sarasota will have a new interim city manager. The city commission was unanimous in selecting Dave Bullock, who has extensive experience in economic development and budget management, to replace outgoing interim manager Doug Jeffcoat. The search for a final city manager continues through specialized firms. Sarasota County is considering the purchase of a 48.9-acre parcel, formerly home to the Gulfgate Executive Golf Course. Supported by environmentalists, water quality proponents, and residents, the project could provide stormwater cleansing and help alleviate flooding. County Commissioner Joe Nunder spoke of it as a great opportunity in light of the 2024 flooding and pointed to additional advantages for parks and recreation. The parcel, valued somewhere between $4 and $11 million, will require a bit of negotiation. This has been Rick Knowlton with your WSLR News Headlines for Thursday, May 22nd, 2025.
Welcome to The Detail. I am your host, Kathy Antunes, and you are listening to The Detail on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton, Florida. Programming at WSLR is supported by listeners like you and by Ringling College Galleries and Exhibitions. Ringling College's 2024-25 exhibition season features art from Ringling students, alumni, faculty, and nationally recognized artists from a wide range of mediums and from diverse backgrounds. More information is available at ringlingcollege.gallery, and the views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. With me today is Ron Shapiro, and you may have heard of Mr. Shapiro. He was the leader who organized the community to oppose the proposed, I call it a pencil tower, the Obsidian, the 342 or 37-foot tower that was denied. The appeal of the neighborhood was upheld by the city commission. That wouldn't have happened without the leadership of Ron Shapiro. He is a retired executive with Procter & Gamble who lived in Bay Plaza. Ron Shapiro, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Kathy.
Okay. Tell me, you and I talked, let's just say this began, your odyssey in advocacy began in 2022. And you and I got together and you were asking me about, you know, what do you do? Because I had led the effort to save Lido Pavilion. And right. I had told you it might take a while.
Yeah. So. And I believe most of what you told me, but that part I didn't, maybe I didn't want to believe. It was going to take 2.5 years, but yeah. That was a pretty good prediction.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's been a long, tough struggle. And as you know, because you've been through it, I mean, you have peaks and valleys. I mean, you really have to hang in there during the valleys and be, but then you have the peaks to kind of help keep you going.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it is something, you know, when the whole Lido thing started happening and they were going to make this family-friendly pavilion basically into a spring break sports bar, it was very easy to see what that future was going to look like. And I think for a lot of activists, you know, for myself as an advocate, for the public realm, I was like, ugh. Because I knew I had to do it. I knew that I couldn't just sit by. And I also knew it was going to take a lot of time, you know, because it wasn't my first rodeo.
Yeah.
let's just, because I want this show, you know, I want to go over the inside story of what you've seen, right? And what you've learned. Because had you ever done anything like this before?
No. No, I mean, it was my first foray into any kind of an activism or, you know, getting involved in local politics at all. I'd been happily retired and just, but this, the reason I got involved was, number one, it seemed so wrong.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Number two, it didn't seem like anybody else was going to kind of step in and do it. Mm-hmm. And number three is that everybody I talked to agreed it was wrong. So it wasn't just my opinion, but it seemed to be strong public opinion from the average people that this was just absolutely the wrong thing to do.
So let me just encapsulate. So if somebody listening, and thank you for joining us, if you've never heard about this issue, this was on Palm Avenue, which is a primary major shopping. It may be the primary shopping street in downtown Sarasota. It's one of them for sure, shopping and dining. This was a building that was proposed for a quarter-acre lot to be about 100 feet taller than any other building surrounding it. It was going to have what's called interstitial space at an amount 7 feet that we'd never seen before.
Right.
Yet it was calling itself at 337 feet tall. It was saying that it was an 18-story building, and a story is basically 20 feet. So it was way more than that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the footprint. I think one of the So it was obvious, like, frankly, some people don't visualize very well, but for the people who do, it was, and for the neighbors nearby, because Bay Plaza is on
basically the surrounds the property. Yeah.
It surrounds it. And it was obvious that the intention was to go up high enough so that there would be many, many units that would have a water view of the bay. The ones on the bottom were going to be looking at your building.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Yeah. So I think one of the most brilliant things that happened was a graphic. Because if you look at the graphic from the architect, they have a graphic of the building that's at an angle on the street, kind of looking up, and it doesn't capture how out of scale it is. But one of the folks you were working with, Tom Waite, on social media, created this graphic that really showed how much taller the building was than everything else. What kind of response did that get? I know I can see how many views it got on Citizens for Sarasota County. It was like 9,000.
Yeah.
There was well, so many.
You know, just like words can be misleading, pictures can be misleading as well. And you referred earlier to the architect's rendition of it for the developer. But yeah, one of the things that I, where Tom was a big help, I really don't do much in terms of social media. And Tom not only knows a lot about social media, but is a very bright guy who has done some marketing work before. And yeah, a picture tells a thousand words. And I think that graphic showing how out of place the obsidian would be to any of the surrounding buildings and the skyline really helped attract a lot of support for the project from not just our neighborhood, but the community at large. I mean, people in the greater Sarasota area, you know, wound up seeing how wrong this would be and got involved in terms of sending emails and attending meetings to support our effort.
So let's just kind of walk through the approval process. How did it get this far? Because in the downtown core of Sarasota, city staff has the power to engage in administrative approval, which is a process that if a development meets the criteria of the code, then the city staff can approve it. It doesn't have to go through the planning board and then the city commission. So this project gained first administrative approval. Then there was an appeal, and it went to the planning board and ultimately wound up with the city commission. So can you kind of walk us through the administrative approval and then the appeal to the planning board? And
yes. Just real quickly as background, this is their second try at getting approval to the building.
Okay.
You know, one of the – in fact, I think it was WSLR had coverage and called it Obsidian 2.0 because their first attempt got rejected by city staff. And I'm mentioning that because their second attempt was very similar to the first one. Yes, they made some changes, but the changes were very minor. And
can I jump in?
Yeah.
It was not approved by city staff that first time, but you all were very actively engaged in lobbying against it, even though there were no hearings.
Oh,
right?
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, you really, because of the process that Kathy just described, I mean, you really have to insert yourself as a member of the public to be heard at all. And you know, it's kind of a difficult and uncomfortable position to be in. But even without that, there's no way that the public perspective is ever going to get heard. The process is really geared to be developer friendly. And there's a lot of ongoing communication between city staff and the developer.
And very little with the public.
Yes, correct.
And so one of the things you did, if I recall correctly, is you just kept showing up at city commission meetings and making comment.
And right.
So for that first piece, before it was denied the first time,
yeah.
How many times did you and your neighbors go and give public comment?
Well, I'm over the course of the project. I've been.
I'm
trying to think about. Yeah, it must have been at least 12 to 15 city meetings that we had at least one or more person show up during the opening part of the city meeting for citizens' input, and you know, tell them and remind them mm-hmm. that we're against this project and here's the reasons why and we're not going away. I mean,
yeah.
It was kind of a ongoing drumbeat of
very proactive
and to let them know we're in this for the duration.
Yeah, very proactive approach. I don't think I've ever seen before. So that was one thing. So it got denied the first time and then it went through again. So good.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that on the second application, while there were some modest changes, they still didn't comply with three requirements in the zoning code in terms of full retail frontage, facades, and habitable space. And they needed a special exception for trash handling to take the trash off premises because they didn't have enough space for the trash mm-hmm. to be picked up on site.
Mm-hmm.
And so those common elements were also part of their first application, which was denied. But the city staff decided to approve this application despite still requiring those adjustments and special exception.
And the height came down what?
Came down 15 feet. It was
15.
Went from 342 to 327.
Okay.
So it was 4%, but that still made it more than 100 feet taller than any other building, you know, in our neighborhood.
Okay.
So
okay.
It was still not compatible with the location.
So people understand it's a quarter acre lot, right?
Yes.
And he the developer paid $3.8 million
right. Yep.
In January of 2022.
Mm-hmm.
So and the proposed building would have to fit, you know, on a quarter acre. So to your
right.
point, like the practical realities of life in a city, where are you going to put your trash bins when you've taken up every square inch of space, right?
Yep.
And there, yep. that was going to be a significant factor.
Sure.
You know? So the city staff approved it because they felt they had enough modifications, but they still, there still were things hanging out there like trash and retail.
Right.
And there are currently seven small businesses that occupy the current storefront. And mm-hmm. there's these cabbage palms in front. It's right in front of the Palm Avenue garage. But these are mom and pops. Like,
right. Small locally owned. Yeah,
yeah,
businesses.
Barber shop, an Italian yeah. restaurant.
Yeah.
Art shop.
Yeah.
Those are actually the kind of business that give a city a sense of place, right? Mm-hmm. That give it the character. They're not chains. They're gathering, like that barber shop. I'll walk by there on
yeah,
Friday
that
night.
Yeah, business goes, does gangbusters. Yeah.
They're cutting hair at 9 o'clock on a Friday night, and it's a social, like that
yeah.
movie barbershop. Like, it's true, right?
Yeah, yeah.
At beauty salons,
come to
every
life.
Woman knows, you
yeah.
know. You want to find out what's going on, talk to your hairstylist. They hear everything. So anyway, they went ahead and approved it. And then what'd you all do?
Well, then the only option we had was appeal it to the planning board. So
okay.
we, you know, filed an appeal with the planning board, and then that hearing took place in February. And, you know, the planning board basically denied our appeal. They thought this project was fine. It was a 4-1 vote. And, you know, that was obviously a huge disappointment to us. And they just felt that even some of them were saying they didn't like the building, but they didn't think they had a reason to deny it.
Yeah.
Now, the only reason we could take it to the planning board was because there were reasons to deny it. I mean, the
you
three
criteria.
Yeah, there were the fact that they needed three adjustments from the city staff, as well as this technical deviation for trash handling, and of course the other criteria that we'll get into talking about, I'm sure, compatibility.
Mm-hmm.
So in our mind, there were like five good reasons to reject the project.
And you had a lawyer there too.
Oh yeah, our attorney Morgan Bentley, who did an excellent job. It was a full day session, and you know, the only member of the planning board that agreed with our appeal was Dan DeLeo, who's mm-hmm. the chairman of the planning board, and Dan seemed very passionate about the fact that the project should be denied and our appeal upheld.
Mm-hmm.
But the other four members just didn't see it that way.
And it reminds me, you know, when I first started getting involved in advocacy, and God bless Nora Patterson, you know, she passed away, I think last year, I used to get very frustrated. She's not the only one who would say this, but she would give all the reasons why something didn't make sense. She would give all the reasons why it was a problem, and then she would vote for it. And she would then she would say, but you know, I have to vote for it. And we, you know, for those of us, it was like Pavlov's dog. I'm going to give you a cookie, and then I'm going to zap you, you know? And it seems like the planning board did that, these four members of the planning board. And I have to take issue, and I want to preface one of my favorite phrases. Everyone's a nice guy, okay? Dan Claremont is a nice guy. But he is a member of the planning board who has given money to a political action committee, and which could reasonably be considered, you know, pro-development interests. His money's in there with some pro-development interests. And I find that he's not the only member of an advisory board or family member of an advisory board member who is now engaging in PAC donations. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the work I've done on dark money, you know, political PACs are a way to skirt campaign finance laws. And the state of Florida, we used to have a limit that only actual people in the city of Sarasota, only actual human beings, the limit is in the city of Sarasota elections, could give money, and they could only give $200 to a candidate. And the state has usurped home rule when it comes to campaign finance, when it comes to many things, but when it comes to campaign finance, the state has, you know, nullified local control and said the limit is $1,000 and corporations can give. So that's one piece. But the other piece is these political committees where you can give thousands of dollars to a PAC. And now we're actually seeing candidates run their own PACs, which is absolutely ethically outrageously corrupt. You know, Martin Hyde made mention, we'll get to that in a minute, about the donations. But getting back to Mr. Claremont, if you're an advisory board member, I just don't think you should be donating to PACs. And and then to be doing this refrain of, well, I don't like this. I really don't like this. I don't like this. But I just don't see that I have reason to vote against it when you've been given chapter and verse very clear reasons. And one of them you just talked about, the main one,
compatibility.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, despite losing the planning board appeal to the planning board, we learned a lot through that process. And in particular, we learned a lot because of Dan DeLeo's strong support for our position. And it made us realize a couple things, obvious in hindsight. But one was we not only had to let the city commissioners know we were against the project, but we had to give them the roadmap linked to the city codes as to why they could reject it on a legal basis and feel justified in doing so. Mm-hmm. Not liking it wasn't enough.
It's never
and
enough.
Who cared, you know, if they liked it or not. I think there was obviously the fear of the threat that I understand was put in the minds of some of the planning board members by the city attorneys that we don't want to reject this project because we'll be taken to court and we don't want the city to be dragged into court by this developer or any other developer. And they hadn't, you know, they didn't fully understand the responsibility or discretion they have. The word discretion is in the zoning code or some of the specific codes themselves in which they could have used as a basis to deny it. So it really gave us, in a sense, the roadmap of, okay, in preparing for the city commissioners meeting, we not only need to let them know how strongly thousands and thousands of residents in the city are against it, but here's the reasons why and why you can be against it and have a legal basis to do so and feel comfortable doing so, besides the fact that you may not like it. I think the second point was, you know, early on, a lot of people were saying, well, you know, compatibility is in the zoning code, but it's subjective and nothing ever gets rejected for compatibility reasons. So you really can't use that as a major argument for denying a project. But at the end of the day, I mean, anybody and everybody you talk to who is against this building, and I never met anybody who was in favor of it other than the developer's team, all use the word compatibility or use words that meant compatibility. I mean,
out of
this
scale,
building and this place just didn't fit.
Yeah.
And so I think that gave us the realization and the impetus that for the appeal for the city commission, we needed to really go hard at compatibility. I mean, that was one of five reasons to deny it, but it was one that I think we hadn't gone hard enough in some of the earlier discussions that we really needed to hit on because it was something that, you know, was so obvious and not
it's
being
like
met.
You're not playing your best card.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was the most compelling argument. It's foundational in, you know, the ruling document when it comes to development in any Florida municipality or county is their comprehensive plan. And I thought I attended the city commission hearing because once the planning board denied your appeal, you had the right to go to the city commission.
Right. Which was our last hope, basically, in terms of getting the city to deny this project.
Yeah. And Morgan Bentley, I thought, was masterful at just clearly walking through the comprehensive plan and walking through city codes at keeping it extremely simple.
Yeah.
And very, very clear. Like, this is a reason for you to say no. You absolutely have the right to say no.
Yep. Yeah.
And I'd never heard anyone tell the story to lay it out as well as he did. I was really like, wow, it's that simple. And so getting to that hearing, incompatibility was the main issue.
Right.
I'm sure you talked with all the city commissioners. I know I saw comment, I think it was on social media, about how Liz Alpert, she was the only dissenting vote. After
yes.
all the evidence was heard,
yeah.
Initially she indicated she was going to vote with the majority and uphold your appeal. But Debbie Trice, Commissioner Trice, said, you know, vote your heart, vote your conscience.
Yeah.
And so she voted
her conscience
against her constituents, basically. She voted to approve the project. And I think, you know, I want to ask you about that because, you know, one of the good things, because Commissioner Alpert is – been on there longer than anyone as a mm-hmm. city commissioner.
Yeah.
And she will listen. But over time, she's a pretty consistent vote for, you know, a green light for projects, regardless of citizen concern.
Sure.
What did you think? Because I'm sure you've had many discussions with her.
Yeah, all the I've gotten to know the commissioners pretty well, and they've gotten to know me, whether they like it or not.
Right.
And one of the things I've learned through this process is you can't take anything for granted, mm-hmm. you know. But we felt we had a particular challenge with, let's say, three of the five commissioners in terms of trying to convince them to support our appeal, mm-hmm. and you know. Mayor Alpert was one of them. And, you know, we invited all of the commissioners to visit the site because going back to the picture tells 1,000 words. It's one thing to read about it and look at it on a piece of paper. But if you come to the site, the whole issue, especially around compatibility, really hits home. And not all the commissioners took us up on that invitation, which is fine. But Mayor Alpert did. And she came and spent well over an hour. You know, we walked around the site. We went up to the top floor. We mm-hmm. pointed out a lot of the concerns and issues. She was clearly engaged. She seemed empathetic to, you know, our points. And, I mean, I wasn't naive enough to assume she was going to agree to support our position because it was a quasi-judicial hearing and, you know. Mm-hmm. But I had heard this from other people on other projects and who, you know, would – engage the mayor before the actual hearing where they got the indication that she was going to support them, but then at the end of the day didn't. So, you know, yeah. we were encouraged by her visit, but again, not naive enough to think that that meant she was going to support us. And
I think it's an approach. I mean, you can look at it as a strategy to mitigate backlash.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I came and I visited and I did this yeah. and I did that. Well, you know,
yeah.
we're still not happy with, you know, we're still not happy with you. It is okay to be unhappy with someone, even if they're nice to you.
Sure.
And,
sure.
you know, you can disagree strongly
yeah.
with how they govern. That's yeah. just legitimate.
Well, I want to just make a quick comment. I mean, the other four commissioners that supported us, I mean, the time and patience and due diligence that they took going yeah. through, you know, the pre-work, the documents they get prior to the hearing and then the hearing itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was reflected in the questions that they asked. The quality of the questions, the in-depth questions, the detail that they really understood and got into. For a couple of the commissioners, I was really impressed with, and I felt that, wow, you know, I give them credit for taking the time and effort. And when it came time for the end of the meeting, when they were, before they actually voted, but just to state their position, they didn't just state they support the appeal and are against the project. They had multiple reasons and specific reasons why they were why they were taking that position. So it was a very and it was a 7-hour meeting. I mean, we started at 10 and ended at 5. So it was a long time to sit and listen. But they really listened. They read through the documents, and they were very thorough in not only their positions, but the reasons why.
That's their job.
Yeah. Well, that's
You know, I mean, and this is where this kind of gets to my point. And yes, that's a good thing. But it shouldn't honestly be in my I'm just speaking for myself.
Well,
the views and opinions on this is mine is that that's their job. And this is a really important decision. And we've got this, I think, unproductive, counterproductive attitude that if they're doing their due diligence or if they're coming out to the site or whatever, we should just be so grateful. Oh, my God, you know. And then if they decide against it, it's like, well, you know, at least they did this and that. Yeah, I don't – I think we can expect more than that. I think we need to. I noted that when you had a site visit with the city, Commissioner Alpert, one of the pieces that Rachel Brown Hackney does incredible work. She writes for the
Sarasota. Yeah, she does a great job.
She's written a great wrap-up article about that hearing. And one of the factors she noted was that there's units in Bay Plaza where this building – the building balcony would literally have been 20 feet away from a neighboring building.
Yeah, from us. Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm. Which is super close.
Yeah.
One of the very interesting bits of public one of the interesting bits of public comment was from an engineer, and he was talking about the foundation of the building.
Right.
And can you, you know, get into, I just sat there kind of spellbound because he basically was saying, I don't know if you can even have in this spot, if you can even have a foundation that's going to work for this super tall building.
Yeah. That was one of the more important parts of the hearing, I believe, because it led to several discussions down the road. But yeah, Bill Carnes, who's a licensed construction engineer in 7 different states, talked about the risk of having to dig down so far and for the foundation for this tall building. And with the tight space and its close proximity to the Bay Plaza building, the risks that would create in terms of, you know, stability for our building.
For your building.
Yeah.
And then how far above sea level?
Yeah, we're only 9 feet. It's only 9 feet above sea level is the elevation. And, you know, that led to a couple of interesting things, if I can just real quickly continue on the subject. But there's a project, and I don't know the name of it, but on Coconut, north of Fruitville, across the street from Cityside going north, that a few months ago they started construction there. I don't even know what the building's going to be, but my wife and I had noticed this because we bike past there pretty regularly or drive past there. The wall was starting to tilt, and it turned out they had to knock that wall down and start over on that project. This was a few months ago.
Really?
And Commissioner Batty raised that question to Larry Murphy, who's the city engineer, during the hearing about that building. And let me backtrack for a minute. One of the questions that Larry Murphy was asked, what about what this construction engineer said and the risks of the foundation? He said, we won't know till we do the soil testing. And so Commissioner Batty then asked about this other site that I mentioned north on Coconut. And, well, what happened there? And basically Larry Murphy said, well, the soil testing was wrong. There was a mistake made in the soil testing. Which would, you know.
Wow.
And Larry, I have to give him credit. I mean, I thought, I don't know the guy. I've never talked to him really, but he was very honest. And he said, you know, we have a small staff. We do the best we can, but we can't do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that reinforced the fears that so many of us had about this project and the health, safety, and well-being of not only those of us that live like 20 feet away, but, you know, the greater neighborhood, pedestrians going by. I mean, people eating outside at Kojo. I mean, the health, safety, and well-being of thousands of people were going to be affected. And so I think that, you know, what the risk that the construction engineer had raised Now, we had raised this issue.
I want to jump in. Okay, so the construction engineer, there was an attorney that the city hired who was a specialist in this real estate law, and he warned the commission that that engineering input from the expert engineer from the public could not be considered because all you could look at right now is whether or not it complied with the code. And you're bringing up Larry Murphy's points. And it seems like such a backwards process. Why wouldn't the city staff, why wouldn't we change our code to require, you know, that the foundation could actually exist before we go through all of this, right? As a community for something, you know, I mean, the compatibility issue, but such a tall building has to be able to be supported.
Yeah.
And yet that is not how the process works.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point because this wasn't the first time that we had shared this risk with the city. Now, maybe the commissioners heard it for the first time, but we had shared it multiple times with the city staff. And the answer was, to your point, Kathy, that's something that gets looked at later when the site plan gets approved. It's not something that's taken into account at this stage of the project. Well, in talking to people that have had been involved in other projects, the public is even less involved in the site plan approval. I mean, as little as we're able to participate in the administrative approval. And once the train has left the station, trying to stop it at the later stage at the site plan is virtually impossible. So we had tried multiple times to raise this issue around the health – and also the – you know, one of the people that testified on our behalf was a gentleman from 1350, John Simon, who talked about the horrors of living next door to the demarque during its construction and all of the issues the 1350 people had to deal with, and the fact that ours would even be worse because it was a taller building that was closer to Bay Plaza.
Can I?
Yeah. And none of those issues the city staff said were relevant at this stage of the process.
So, I mean, logically speaking, they're relevant. Just human safety-wise, they're relevant. But because it doesn't fit into the certain, you know, it's a round peg in a square hole from what they're saying. And that I think, is an important takeaway for maybe the city commission to go, listen, you know, we first things first. If a foundation can't be built, why would we waste so much time, our resources? You know, time is you can't get back your time. Why would you waste everybody's time and your time, you know?
And if the city doesn't have a responsibility for the health, safety, and well-being of its residents, what role does it play? I mean, to me, that has to be 1, 2, and 3 at the top of their list of what the responsibilities that they have.
People also talked about Dolphin Tower.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were foundation issues that was – residents had an hour. They were told, you have got to leave this building. And it remained, you know, unoccupied for a number of years before it was – completed. You know, we saw what happened with Surfside, you know, on the East Coast. And you know, I have to say, I've served on many condo board a number of years. The laws have changed quite a bit, but you still have to build something really sound in the beginning and not set a community up, because every condo is a community of people.
Sure.
And to set them up for potentially financial devastation for some of the residents, and not everyone's going to have the same financial cushion is really a reprehensible thing to do. So that was a huge takeaway for me sitting listening to that engineer. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And also, and the lawyer telling him you can't consider that.
Yeah. And also this site, because it was basically surrounded by the Bay Plaza property, the only access to the site was from North Palm Avenue, which, as you said, is a main pedestrian thoroughfare, which makes, from what I understand from talking with the construction engineers and architects, makes the construction even more difficult and riskier because they can't access normal construction site. You can access from multiple points. And having that access only from North Palm Avenue makes what's a risky construction already that much more challenging and riskier.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I want to get back to campaign contributions because the ever colorful Martin Hyde came and he raised a legitimate point. At the end of his input, he talked about how I think it might have been Commissioner Alpert got the most in terms of campaign support from Hoyt Architects, $6,500. And to my point earlier, in the self-governance and what city residents have approved, only individuals can give $200 apiece. This is not, if it were up to city residents, this would not be allowed to exist. But through contributions, and I expect perhaps political PAC, well, political PAC donations are completely unlimited, mm-hmm. but Commissioner Alpert, Martin Hyde brought up, you know, you've gotten $6,500 from people connected with Hoyt Architects or the firm itself. I'm not sure which, but she didn't take issue with that number. She didn't say, oh, no, that's not true. What she said was, I'm not influenced by that, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, okay. And then Commissioner Batty, and I think the city commission, another thing I know is there's two things. They make speeches about being offended that someone would question the influence of campaign money on them. Stop it. We're your constituents, and we are allowed to raise that question. It's not a bad question. You shouldn't be offended by it. It's a reality that people who give money do expect to be able to have your ear, you know, but don't trash
like given
the citizen.
Given a presidential jet, you know, there might be something expected in return for
there
that.
There might be something expected. Yeah. And then the other piece was, oh gosh,
and
now I'm forgetting
the people. I think it's an obvious question. They don't need to accept these contributions, do they? Does somebody have a gun to their head that's saying you got to accept this money from this party?
I know one candidate who gave money like that back. That was Kathy Kelly Ulrich. Because she just wanted to take money from residents.
Yeah. Okay.
You know? So, I know what the other thing is. They have a default, and I think, City Commission, you need to stop doing this. And I think it was Martin Hyde when they were saying that's a personal attack. And he said, it's not a personal attack. It's just a fact. It's an unhappy fact for you. It's just reality. So this way, you know, I think our public officials need to get a little heartier and understand that somebody pointing out a conflict of interest or getting support or being involved with a group or whatever might sway you is not a personal attack. It's civic engagement. It's accountability. And accountability is not it's not a personal attack. It was very good to see the pushback and also that it was dropped. When it was pushed, there was some pushback, it was dropped. You know, like the commissioner didn't go on about it. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, before I've seen when Rob Grant was talking about campaign contributions, and this was it's a different project where a public street was essentially, it's not a done deal, but Cross Street has been vacated potentially, right?
Yep.
For a development, it's a little street off of the roundabout at Pineapple and Ringling. There's no reason, in my view, to give that to a developer. You don't have a site plan. You know, they're running on promises. There's no tangible reason. And when Rob Grant gave input and started to talk about campaign contributions, he was shut down by Commissioner Trice. And I think, and I was surprised. I was sitting next to him. And I was like, the man's just... And even they were saying they were giving a technical reason.
He's just stating
reason.
Facts, right?
He's stating
facts. I mean, he's
facts.
Not speaking untruths, you know.
Yeah, and they were giving, I think, rationale that made no sense. I'll have to look that up. I should write about that, because these are the little widgety type ways that the public discussion gets thwarted and I think distorted to shut down effective public speakers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here, Rob Grint is definitely one of those.
Yeah.
Talk to me, Ron, about, did you ever work with the developer or talk with them? Were they interested? It's Mr. Matthew Kinke. Is that his name?
I was in a couple meetings that we had with the developer and his team early on in the project. And, you know, they didn't get very far from our point of view. I mean, there were some things that they were asking from us to make their, you know, project easier, especially from a construction standpoint. And, of course, there were some things we were asking from them, and it was clearly going to be a one-way street. I mean, they were interested in getting us to, you know, provide some liens on our property or access to this and that. But they weren't willing to really compromise at all from their side in terms of the size and the scope of the building and the project.
Yeah.
So we realized after a couple meetings that, you know, we really had no choice. Because there was even a point months ago during one of our many city meetings where we talked, and Commissioner Trice said, well, why don't you just go talk to the developer and, you know, work things out with him. And at the subsequent city meeting, I had to, you know, address that and explain, you know, we've had a couple meetings and we tried and, you know, it was going to be a one-way street.
Happening.
We had no other. And because of the administrative process, we had no other choice than to do what we were doing to fight the project.
The developer, there was an article in a local magazine that I found, frankly, disappointing. This was at least a year ago. And it was describing the project. It felt more like a real estate advertisement.
Mm-hmm. I know which one you're talking about. Yeah.
And it was talking about, and, you know, I'm using this as an example of, you know, there's talk and then there's actual reality in terms of planning standards. And so one of the things that you want in a city, and I talk about a lot on the show, is walkability, a comfortable, interesting, safe place with lots to do. And there's a couple terms that get batted around a lot that some of them I think we should retire because they're overused. One of them's vision. You know, everyone's got this. And so it was the vision for the building, the vision of this. And the other is vibrant, which I love the word vibrant, but it's used all the time. It's losing its efficacy. When I was reading that article about the building and it felt more like a real estate advertisement, it was the vision for the building was essentially it's going to have a fire pit and it's going to have a bocce court and it's going to have massage rooms and it's going to have a golf course simulator. And it's, you know, it was all these like amenities. I don't know if I can even think of them all. And I live, I live in a downtown condo and there are buildings going up around me that have the same kind of promises, but I know from ones that have already gone up and talking with neighbors, these amenities don't wind up getting used very much at all. Like some, but my point being, it's not visionary to add those amenities.
Yeah, so it's something they can put on their website, but who cares?
Right. Kind of who cares? And so in a time when we have all this affordable housing, you know, that interstitial space, and I have to correct myself because last week I gave the wrong number.
Okay.
It was 7 feet between the floors of interstitial space. That's the correct number that they were wanting to have that much space.
Yeah, and it varied by floor, but yeah, some of them were as much as seven, yeah.
Yeah, and so, and of course, my feeling, the feeling of people who are concerned about this, was you're doing that to raise the height of the building, right? But it feels like we are in a second gilded age in the United States, the Gilded Age in the U.S., the last Gilded Age was during the time of robber barons and, you know, Andrew Carnegie and the railroad people and the bank people, J.P. Morgan, just super, super amounts of wealth, just tons and tons of wealth. And those men did a lot of good, you know, some like Carnegie Libraries, you know, that were all over the country. But the difference between the haves and have-nots was massive. And then post-World War II and Depression, there was a new economic order put in place, Keynesian economics, which changed things and gave rise to the middle class. And then in the late 70s, or really it started with Nixon, those economic factors have been gradually chipped away. And we're back in a Gilded Age, you know, we're back with the haves and have-nots. And to me, this building is a symbol of ridiculous excess in a place that made no sense for people who probably have two or three homes. But it was basically like, we're going to do what we want and we don't care about the rest of the community. And how it impacts them.
Yeah, and, you know, early on, it reminds me, during some of the different meetings that we voiced our opposition, the developer and his team were talking and making analogies of this building to the Ringling Bridge or the Selby Gardens expansion, and that those projects had public opposition early on, but then once they were built, everybody loved them. And I was like, come on, you're comparing this ridiculous skyscraper in this location to those, you know, I mean, the Ringling Bridge. I mean, plus, you know.
That everybody uses.
Yeah, and, right. Yeah. And so that was just such a ridiculous, but it kind of shows the attitude of the people trying to make this happen. And it does remind me of one other point, kind of in the context of Gilded Age, the haves and the have-nots, is that in all of the city meetings over the last 2.5 years, including the you know, the planning board appeal and the one of the commissioners, there was not one person from the public that spoke in favor of this building, other than the team that was hired and being paid big bucks by the developer, his architects and attorneys. And you know, there were hundreds of people that spoke out against it through all of those meetings. And you know, I've started to attend some of the other city meetings and hearings, and I haven't, every other one I've attended, there's always been at least somebody on the other side. You know, this was so strongly against the building that there wasn't one person from the public that ever stepped forward and thought this was a good idea.
And I have to say, I told you this before the show, I was sitting down to dinner with my son. He was living in the Netherlands for a while and he recently moved home. And, we're sitting at dinner. He goes, "Mom, have you heard about this really tall building that got denied?" I just looked at him like, "I've done about like 5 radio shows in that building." And he's like, "Oh, I say to you, you know, you can't be a prophet in your own hometown. You can't be an expert on local issues in your own family." But the penetration. Like for my son who, you know, hasn't lived here back here that long, he knew all of, you know, he knew about it. He had seen the graphic. He'd been like, "Oh my God, this is nuts."
Yeah.
So, I think for me, I look at this stuff and the process, and I have an understanding of what it takes, you know, the work that it takes. You have an understanding, and quite frankly, I don't think we should have to work so hard to defeat things that are so foolish that the public so clearly doesn't want. And I'm not sure if it's just more responsive commissioners or getting a better process in place. When the groups stop, you know, Marlon Brown, when he was congratulating Liz Alpert on her win on social media, he was talking negatively about a group called Stop, which I didn't think that was necessarily the best name, but they were protesting administrative approval.
This was 7 years ago, right?
It was like 5 or 6. And so the point being, administrative approval for projects works if you feel you have a city culture and a staff that will follow the code. And I would really say it was the culture under Mr. Brown that had people very concerned, or even the culture in the city that developers just have way too much sway, way too much influence. And as long as they do, administrative approval is a concern.
Yeah.
Like, this, you shouldn't have had to spend 2.5 years fighting something so stupid.
Yeah. Well, you know? I think, you know, it reminds me, too, or the thought of one of the things that helped us win the appeal was the strong base of public support. It wasn't just the people in Bay Plaza or the people in the neighborhood. It was like throughout the greater Sarasota area. And I think those people supported us for three reasons. One was they thought it was a bad idea in and of itself. Secondly, they were afraid the precedent it would set that if this could get built in this location, what's going to happen next door to where I live, wherever that might be, as crazy as it might be.
There, you couldn't say no.
Yeah, and the third one is just to see how much development has gone on in Sarasota in the last 5 to 10 years, much of which seems to be out of control and without any, you know, any guardrails at all.
Yeah.
I think that's what really got the public to realize the only way this building is going to get stopped is if we support the group, you know, fighting it because of those reasons.
Yeah. Yep. And to that end, what would you say to people moving forward, people who live in the city, if they want to be part of a solution to a more, you know, a built environment that's user-friendly, you know, that's going to work for everyone.
Yeah. You know, I said this at the meeting last week, is I hope in some ways that this project might be a bit of a tipping point, because everybody's been congratulating us, which was great, and saying, like, they've never seen, you know, the developer get rejected. And so, I mean, it's almost like it's unheard of. At least it's been a long time. So I think you know, you need to put the time and effort and get involved. I mean, it really is, it takes time. You need to understand what the regulations are. You need to support the commissioners. And, you know, to me, it makes elections, local elections, more important
than
ever.
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, there's a couple of seats that are going to be up next year. And, you know, who we elect is important. I mean, I really, going back to last fall, where Kathy Kelly Ulrich, you know, replaced Eric Arroyo, if that change didn't happen in the commission, I'm not sure if we would have won the appeal or not. You know, the reputation that Arroyo had was a very strong supporter of developers. So I would expect he would have supported it, and that would have been 3-2 instead of 4-1, and who knows, you know, what other votes he might have helped sway. So
yeah.
Local elections are absolutely critical.
They are. And on that note, Ron Shapiro, thank you so much for your service to our community.
Thanks, Kathy.
I know that if you had not led that effort, if there had been no organized public opposition, it would have been approved. So thank you very much for the work that you've done. And I hope you stay engaged and come back anytime to talk about things that are concerning to you. And everybody, you have been listening to The Detail on WSLR 96.5, LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, and WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton, Florida. Be sure to stay tuned for more public affairs programming here on WSLR. Make it a great day.